Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Well, hello and welcome. It's Wednesday, the 24th of February, 2021, and you're listening to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and with me to discuss some of the current issues in the industry is Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news at www.theconstructionindex.co.uk. Hello again, Phil.
Hello, David. You're so old. No one says www. anymore. I'm surprised you're not saying http://.
Yeah, it's just habit, I suppose. I know you don't even have to put www. Into your browser, your search engine now, do you?
If you just say the Construction Index, they'll find us.
The Construction Index. Yeah, sorry, I'm showing my age. I'm an old dinosaur here. Oh, well.
Anyway, how are you this fine morning?
Well, I'm fine. I've just been trying to make sense of this new roadmap from Mr. Johnson, the Prime Minister, and I think I must have been holding it upside down. I mean, I've never been very good at map reading, but I can't really make sense of this one. So I noticed that Boris Johnson was quoted yesterday as saying that there's no credible route out of zero COVID Britain anyway. So I don't know why he bothered to issue a map. We'll just have to see how it goes. I'm staying locked down until I'm told it's safe to come out.
The key dates are when you can hug your granny and when you can have a pint of beer in a pub garden with a big thick coat on.
Yeah, well, I won't be hugging my granny anytime soon anyway, that's for sure. So, Phil, there's some interesting topics in the news this week that we're going to discuss. Employment seems to be a theme, particularly direct employment and the way people actually work inside the construction industry. There was a report out recently, wasn't there?
Well, there've actually been a couple of reports out, one this week and one a couple of weeks ago, which are relevant to this subject. But the peg behind all of this is come April, there are changes to what's called IR35, which is the Inland Revenue Announcement number 35 of some year in the not too distant past. But basically, IR35 is shorthand for how... It's the tax treatment of people who are self-employed. People talk about bogus self-employment, which is itself a slightly pejorative term. But there are different ways that you can be self-employed. And it's been a long-running issue for the construction industry. And the reports that I'd like to just briefly flag up this morning, the first one... we ran a story on the 5th of Feb from the Electrotechnical Joint Industry Board. It's a report written by an academic, a chap called Howard Gospel from King's College London, called Direct Employment, a Study of Economic, Business and Social Outcomes Based on the Electrical Contracting Sector. Now, it's all, as the title suggests, it's specific to the electrical contracting sector, but everything it says is pertinent and relevant to the general construction sector. Mm. And what it basically does, it makes a case for direct employment of construction employees rather than just using relying on casual labour, is a good thing. Mm. There are economic benefits to all concerned. Now, this is something that the trade union movement, of course, has long been fighting for and campaigning for better rights for construction workers who are historically have been treated pretty shoddily. They're disposable. They come and go. You win a job, take people on, possibly, you know, driving in a van and picking people up at the street corner who they're waiting, and they do the job, get paid a lump sum every week or month or whatever, and when the job's done, they're let go and they have to find another job somewhere else. That's how it's historically worked, a lot of the industry, and the unions have quite naturally long campaigned for better treatment of construction workers. What is interesting about the current environment is that the bosses seem to have correct employment. There's a forward to this JIB report, co-written by TUC President Gail Cartmail and Andy Mitchell, who's a name that should be familiar to most listeners as the chairman of the Construction Leadership Council, chair of Construction Leadership Council, I should say. And they together put their names to the sentence that says, the report acknowledges that subcontracting and self-employment remain essential features of electrical contracting in other parts of construction, but over recent decades, the balance has been allowed to tip too far away from direct employment. And it says if the industries and the government's priorities for this and future decades are to be achieved, safety, quality, skills, efficiency, innovation, then a healthier, more sustainable balance now needs to be restored. Now, they're saying we're always going to need, the nature of the industry means we're always going to need to be able to take people on quickly and let them go quickly as decently as it can be done, because, you know, Bradford has a new shopping centre. Lots of people go to Bradford to build the shopping centre. The job's finished. And then, right, now where do we go? Oh, Gateshead's having a school built or something. And you know, it's a peripatetic industry, always has been. It's the nature of the industry. It's a thorny one. It's an interesting one.
It is.
And anyway, that was the economic case for the benefits of direct employment were made in the Joint Industry Board report. Then this week, an organisation called the Institute for Public Policy Research, a leftish think tank, wrote a report called Skills for a Green Recovery. Now, this was slightly different. It wasn't specifically talking about direct employment. It was talking about the Prime Minister set out his 10-point plan for a green recovery and what we need to do to get out of the economic COVID-induced slunk that we're in. And their report is saying, OK, how equipped is the construction industry to do this? And it's talking about skills and other aspects of the weaknesses of the construction industry. And one of the key weaknesses it sees, one of the key problems that the construction industry has that it needs to address if it's going to be properly fit for the future, is this issue of self-employment. And this IPPR organisation is recommending that Parliament establishes a cross-party commission to investigate options for tackling bogus self-employment. And they show their colours there by using the term bogus. Tackling bogus self-employment in the construction sector. So, interesting quote. The construction sector has become reliant on cheap and insecure labour.
I found that phrase rather disingenuous, because I mean the construction sector has always been reliant on cheap and insecure labour. I mean that's true,
but they point out that 40% of the UK workforce is self-employed, which is higher than anywhere else in Europe.
Yeah.
Although I think that statistic is possibly, I won't say it's misleading, but the background to that statistic is that's not 40% of people who are casual labourers.
No.
That 40% includes people who might be perfectly, respectably, gainfully, professionally employed.
But self-employed.
But in maybe through their own personal limited company or some other sense. But yes, that we do have a, you know, not all of those self-employed are insecure, I would suggest, that all those 40%. But there is a high degree of insecurity and that breeds inequality and difference in rights, in you know, employment rights.
But as you rightly point out, the whole nature of the industry, the fact that building sites are of necessity temporary workplaces, means that you've got a very mobile workforce and you are highly reliant on casual labour and local suppliers. And so that's always going to be a problem. I think the problem which is being outlined in this particular report is the fact that they're talking not about the genuine need for self-employed people and casual labour and that kind of thing, but people who are posing as self-employed people when actually they're operating effectively as employees. And the problem there, of course, is that the Inland Revenue, or sorry, the HMRC as it is now, is missing out, because if you are... Well, let's get back to IR35, which is, if you like, this milestone which comes up on the 6th of April. IR35 was actually introduced by Gordon Brown when he was the Chancellor of the Exchequer under Tony Blair. This was back in 1999, I think, over 20 years ago now. The idea was that you would have to demonstrate, well, up until IR35 came in, a self-employed contractor or freelancer was responsible for deciding their tax status, basically. They reported to HMRC and said, I'm a self-employed contractor, so I won't be, I won't have tax and national insurance contributions deducted at source. I'll do that myself.
714 used to be the jargon in the olden days. Does it still exist, 714? I don't know, but that was the number.
Yes, I think that came in the 1960s or something, and that was
71.
Yeah, was it? Well, a 714 certificate was a document which was issued by the Inland Revenue, as it was then, to confirm an individual's self-employed tax status. So basically, it said they were self-employed for tax purposes, and it only applied in the construction industry. So they just presented that and said, well, you don't deduct tax and national insurance contributions at source, I'm paying it myself. And that was replaced by the construction industry scheme, the CIS scheme, in the late 1990s, about the same time as IR35 came in. The thing about IR35, the change which is coming through in April, is that it will no longer be the actual subcontractor, the self-employed contractor or
individual
freelancer. Yeah, it will no longer be them deciding their tax status. It will be their employer, if their employer is a medium to large size company, not necessarily a small company.
Which is that 50 million turnover? Is that the threshold? Or is it 50 employees? I've got 50 in my head.
I think there are three criteria, and I have them written down here, so I shall find them.
It might be 50 employees or £10 million turnover.
Well, what it is, HMRC defines a medium to large size client as having two out of the three following features: turnover of more than £10.2 million a year.
Aha!
A balance sheet of more than £5.1 million, and or an average of more than 50 employees. Now,
well, that's not bad. I got two out of three. Yeah.
I don't know where that leaves your tax status, Phil. I won't pry into that. But but the thing is that with IR35, the problem has been that freelance contractor, self-employed contractor, an individual. Well, you can operate as a sole trader, but a lot of them choose to operate as through a limited company. They set up a limited company. It's their own limited company. And their employer or their client doesn't pay them directly. They pay their limited company. And so they then take their money, their payment, in the form of, I think some can be, a small proportion can be as a salary from their limited company, but most of it comes...
Well, you can take something like...
Go on.
Yes, you can take a certain amount tax-free as a salary, and then you take dividends for the rest, which is taxed at a lower rate.
Yes.
And that's the benefit of being a limited company.
And there are ways of operating this. For example, you could take your entire salary in one lump sum, and you only pay one set of national insurance contributions or something like this. There are huge tax and national insurance savings to be made by working this way. And for employers, for the contractors themselves, the client, that is, there are also advantages because, of course, if they're paying this chap as a separate company, a bona fide subcontractor, they're not paying employers' national insurance contributions. They're not providing employment benefits such as sick pay, holiday pay, that kind of thing. And so there's a huge sort of hole in the net that all this money is sort of disappearing through, and HMRC wants to patch that up and basically make sure that these apparently self-employed subcontractors are paying the same amount of tax and national insurance as somebody doing the same sort of job on an employed basis. So that's what IR35 is all about. And in fact, for people operating like this, for public sector clients, they've been covered by IR35 since April 2017. The change which is taking place in April is that this will now apply in the private sector as well. So something is being done to tackle bogus self-employment.
Yes, which I thought was a weakness of the IPPR report, that it didn't even acknowledge the existence of the IR35 reforms. So I thought, if you're talking about this whole issue, you have to at least acknowledge this is going on, I would have thought.
Yeah.
But let me float something here. I haven't thought it through, and it may be a terrible idea, but if we acknowledge that the construction industry needs the freedom to be able to take on labour quickly, mm-hmm. and let it go quickly as jobs come and go, such is the nature of the industry, is there a case there for a trade-off, if you like, for encouraging direct employment for relaxing other labour laws for the construction industry as a special case that makes it easier to let people go, to fire people. Because it's quite expensive to let people go for any length of time, certainly. Would that be a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, obviously, it's bad if you let go.
But I know what the unions would say.
Yes, but at least if you're going to be directly employed, properly employed, with all the benefits that implies
yes.
for the duration of the job, and then the employer knows that they can let those people go.
It's an interesting point. I don't know how you'd work that. I suppose if you wanted to make it easy to hire people on a casual basis and then employ them as direct employees, you would need to modify that arrangement somehow to make it, if the nature of the employment is genuinely temporary, then clearly you don't want somebody saying, well, you can't let me go. I work for you now. I have employment rights.
There's always the risk of one form of abuse replacing another,
exactly.
I suppose.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that's probably why this has been such a perennial problem for the industry, that because of the way it works, because you need regional workforces working regionally for national contractors, you've got this fluid employment arrangement where your workforce isn't continuous and they're not always the same people. So you have to have some flexibility. I don't know. I mean, obviously, the 714 certificate arrangement was an obvious solution at the time. That was, I think, in fact, it was the employees, the workers, who spoke out against that mostly because, of course, they were, they might have had some tax benefits back then under the 714 arrangement, but they did suffer from appalling working conditions, and there was a problem of employment abuse on site, because it's very difficult to police a construction site, at least it certainly was 40 or 50 years ago. If you remember, there was the Shrewsbury 2? I think there are probably more than two. We talked about them in the past.
Yeah, a dozen of them.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Who really, there was a national construction strike, wasn't there?
1971, 72, was it?
Something like that, yeah. And that led to all sorts of problems. And in fact, a lot of the problems haven't gone away. There was the whole blacklisting episode, which dragged on and on and on through various different guises. So it's a tricky problem, and it's not an easy one to solve, obviously.
Although the whole issue of casual labour is still an issue, but it's not what it was, and it's becoming less of an issue. It's not like the McAlpine's army building the motorways or whatever, yeah. where you had literally an army of labourers with picks and shovels doing hard manual labour. In fact, we've got a lot more mechanisation now and computer-controlled mechanisation. We've got a lot of off-site construction, a lot of stuff being done in factories and big pieces craned into place. There is, I'd be interested to see a study on this, but in general terms, there is a lot less. What's the gender-neutral term for manpower? Labour?
Labour,
muscle.
Yes.
on-site. There's less of it. There's less need for, we're doing a building job, let's get 100 people from off the street and put shovels in their hands. Mm. Those sort of jobs tend not to go on.
Have you ever done any casual building work, Phil, off the books, as it were?
Only helping out builders who I've employed to do landscaping work in the garden or something. I've been fetching and carrying person. Yes.
Yeah.
Chap who did did the patio, I'd be pushing the wheelbarrow and that sort of thing. So I've been the lad.
Oh, right. Okay, I see. I did a bit of roofing work back in the 1980s for a neighbour of mine, because I found myself newly unemployed, and he was a roofer painting a roof on a building on an army base in Shropshire. And he needed some help, so I thought, yeah, I'll go and work for him. It never occurred to me that what I was doing might have been wrong. I was certainly below the tax threshold, so I wasn't bothered about not paying any tax.
And you were probably 12 at the time, were you?
A little bit older than that. Not much, though. But yeah, I was working on a roof with no PPE and absolutely no training whatsoever. never occurred to me back then. This was only in the 1980s that there was anything wrong with doing that. I thought he was doing me a favour and I was helping him out. So, it's the only time I've ever worked on the lump, as it were.
And what did you spend the cash on? New hi-fi, I bet.
Beer and food, actually.
Oh, dull.
Certainly beer. I don't know. So there we are. That's direct employment.
Yeah, and I think to emphasise the takeaway from this is that the Construction Leadership Council is fully behind this. This is not a, you know, unions versus bosses issue anymore. The industry leaders recognise that something needs to be done. And one of the interesting stats I wanted to pull out from the IPPR, Institute of Public Policy and Research report, which did interest me, sort of statistic I like, well, I shouldn't like it, it's a bad statistic, but it's interesting. 5 years ago, this chap, Mark Farmer, wrote a report which got a lot of oxygen and publicity about it, about the, you know, how the, what was it called, something or die, reform or die, change or die, adapt or die.
That's right. I can't believe that was 5 years ago. It's incredible.
One of those. And Mark Farmer's report found that the proportion of workers aged under the age of 30 was 22.8%. 22.8% of the construction industry was under 30 5 years ago. Now it's gone down to 20.3%. So, in other words, the ageing profile of the industry has got noticeably worse in just 5 years. More than a third of the workers in the sector are over the age of 50, implying that 750,000 workers are basically retiring in the next 15 years. That's quite... And the reason why this report flags up those statistics is it's saying that we need to make the construction industry a more attractive place to work, because we need to get people into it. We need people.
Yeah, that's always been the battle cry, hasn't it? We have to make construction an attractive career option. And people... You hear that when people talk about just employment generally, but certainly also talking about getting ethnic minorities and more women into the industry. You know, it's just not an attractive place for them to work. Well, you know, no, I suppose it isn't. It's getting more like that, as you say. If we're doing more off-site work, then less muddy site and less exposure to muddy sites.
That's not the issue. Pay them more.
Pay them more.
Pay people, they will come. People used to queue up to work on the oil rigs in god-awful conditions in the 70s and 80s because it was good pay. Yeah.
Talking about jobs for the boys, there's been quite a high-profile appointment made recently, hasn't there? Somebody on definitely directly employed and on a much better salary.
You're talking about a chap at the HSE, the Health and Safety Executive.
That's right, yes. He was headhunted.
There's a very important new organisation, which we've discussed before, called the Building Safety Regulator, which is part of the fallout from the Grenfell Tower fire. Dame Judith Hackett was commissioned by government to do a big report into what the lessons of the Grenfell Tower are, and there are, as we've talked about, numerous in all sorts of directions. Mm. And one of her recommendations was a new building safety regulator. And it made sense that when it's set up, it was going to be set up as under the aegis of the Health and Safety Executive. And Judith Hackett did this big report. She herself is a former chair of the HSE, and she is now the, I don't know if it's an interim, but the inaugural chair of the building safety regulator. And the big new post that was created was the chief executive?
Chief Inspector of Buildings, I think is the title.
So HSE set out the headhunters, big hunt for who's going to be the new person at the head of building safety in the UK. And the person they found after an exhaustive and probably expensive recruitment process was the existing head of construction at the HSE, Peter Baker. Now that might be really sensible. I have no doubt that he is a great man for the job. Yeah. He's certainly steeped in health and safety and public service and all good things. But it feels a bit of a disappointment that we've already got a director of building safety and construction at the HSE. We've got this new organisation coming in with a big fanfare, building safety regulator, and it seems like it's just been stuck on the guy who's already sort of doing that job.
Yeah, well, it's not as if it's a new job. Well, it is a new job, but it's in addition to his existing job, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's still doing the same job. as well.
I don't know what to feel about that, because I mean, this guy, as you said, I mean, he's got fantastic credentials and he's obviously well qualified for the post, but I don't know. I was sort of expecting it to be somebody who would do this full time, not as a sort of a sideline to his day job sort of thing.
But what it feels like, it's less like a new organisation and more like a new job description.
Yes, that's probably right.
The terms and reference of his job have changed because of new legislation and regulations. Mm. This is what the head of building safety and construction of the HSE now does as well.
Yeah.
I'm sure it made no sense to have two different people doing those two different jobs, but it does somehow feel as though at some point along the line it wasn't thought through properly.
Yeah. Well, also, the fact that they employed an expensive Mayfair recruitment firm to scour the universe for the best possible person for the new job, and he was hiding behind a desk in Canary Wharf or Tothill Street all the time.
Sitting right next to them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Hello, I'm over here.
You get a lot of that, haven't you? You know, I'm sure lots of listeners have had experience having to reapply for their own job.
Yeah, well, it's due diligence, isn't it? They can't just...
Especially in the public sector. Well, there's another one, actually. This morning, we're speaking on Wednesday. Wednesday morning, ran a piece. The Office of Rail and Road, which is the bit of the Department of Transport, which is the sort of the watchdog for Network Rail and Highways England, they've just announced that they've got a new chief executive. But this chief executive has been interim chief executive since the beginning of October 2019. He's been interim chief executive.
Mm.
And they're saying, after a well-contested competition, we're delighted that we found this fabulous chap to take on this job. And you think, 2.5 years as interim chief executive?
Well, he had some very relevant experience, presumably.
Well, clearly, it just seems...
Have you ever done anything like this before?
For about 2.5 years, mate.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I mean, but it wasn't even new to the job. I mean, he'd been on the board of the organisation for a year before that. And this is not a comment on the people getting these jobs. It's just so the public sector recruitment process is a bit of a mystery. I mean, as you say, all these checks and balances they have to follow. But if he was right in October 2019... How did it take them so long to decide that he was still right? Why did when I got it, I got this press release announcing this, my initial reaction was, oh, there must be something quite sensitive behind there. There must be some issue with, you know, perhaps the previous chief executive has been off sick for a very long time and it's all a bit up in the air and they weren't quite sure whether they were coming back or not. And, you know, under those circumstances, you can't make someone interim if the actual chief is still there, in the background but unable to work or something. So I thought there had to be some backstory to this. So I asked the question, got no answer back at all. so I looked into it myself and I found, no, his predecessor, who left in October 2018, is Director General of a division of the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy and doing a good job there. So the person who had it before went on to do another job in government, presumably a bigger and better job.
Yeah, and left a vacancy.
And so there's no one hovering in the background. He could have got this job on a permanent basis much earlier if other things had been equal. But the interesting thing is that his predecessor was also interim chief executive for 13 months before she got the job on a permanent basis. I mean, what is this? It's taking a year and a half or 3.5 years or year to decide.
A probation period, isn't it? I have to say.
I'd have packed up and left, I think.
Well, yes, you're on a knife edge, aren't you, I suppose, if you're interim. But I don't know. We don't know what sort of assurances were made behind closed doors.
Mind you, in your civil service, you get fabulous pension terms and everything. That's so you don't want to be leaving anything in a hurry, do you?
But it's not just the public sector that does this sort of thing. I mean, you get board directors on FTSE 100 companies who are ostensibly temporary or interim executives, and they just morph into full-time bona fide executives eventually. It doesn't happen very often, but you do see it happen from time to time. I suppose more frequently they're there for about 18 months and then they get kicked out. So,
should we change the subject?
Yes, let's
David, I would like to talk about something completely not news related.
Okay.
It's just a bugbear of, I know, of very, very many people, particularly, I think, journalists, because us, you and I being journalists, we have a particular interest in words, the usage of words, mm-hmm. their meanings. Therefore, with that comes an antipathy, no, more than that, an hatred yes. of jargon, especially yes, when yes. it's meaningless. And one can think of countless bits of jargon. And I'm not talking about euphemisms here. I'm talking specifically about jargon. And I want to talk about, firstly, one which is not specific to construction, but very relevant to construction, increasingly relevant to construction. And secondly, one which is very specific to construction.
Go on
the first
then.
One is digital.
Digital, just the word digital.
The word digital. Now, I keep reading all these reports about construction is too slow to take up digital technology. We need to digitize the construction industry.
Yes.
Now, I understand what BIM is, for example, or CAD. Now, that's jargon, but it yeah. is what it is. I have no problem with that sort of a jargon.
Well, they're acronyms, aren't they? So, I mean, you can
yes,
forgive
but,
those.
Yes. But even you know, computer aided design, building information modeling, it's they mean something. Even
yeah.
the word television was a piece of jargon, and it was a dreadful
yes.
portmanteau word when it, you know, hybrid of Greek and Latin, for God's
yes.
sake, when it came along. But accept it, you know, language change, new words come along, and a very useful word the television is, and we know what a TV is, and I have no problem with that word, despite its derivation, its hybrid derivation. But digital, its derivation is digit. It means finger. It means of or appertaining to a finger. That's what digital means. And then it became to do with, you know, digital clocks instead of having two hands going, one going quicker than another around a circle.
Yeah.
We had clocks that actually displayed numbers flashing up and changing to show the time. That was a digital clock.
Yes.
And that was probably my first experience of digital meaning something other than of or appertaining to fingers. And now we sort of know that it's what we used to call computers or IT or something.
Yeah.
But it means everything. I mean, email is digital communication, but so is, I mean, satellite. It now sort of anything embracing ones and noughts is digital. And why it gets me is I keep reading the thing about the construction industry needs to be more digital. It's slow to be digital. Okay, what do you mean? Everyone I know in construction has got email. They're all digital.
Yeah, you're being too literal, Phil. You're being far too literal. I mean, the thing about the word digital is that we all know what it means now. It's
no, I don't know what it means. What does it mean? That's my point.
Yeah, all right, then you've got me there. It means it's the latest electronic communications technology. But it's easier to say digital.
The latest.
Yeah.
Are you saying when caveman put a piece of string between two tin cans to talk to his mate, he was being digital?
Where did he get tin cans from? Never mind that.
I just think if you're talking about digital, what do you mean? I don't mean you specifically. I mean whoever's using that term. It is just too vague, and it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, I see that so often now that, I mean, it doesn't rile me the way it riles you, but loads of other things do. When people talk about, you know, that the industry must become more digital, I sort of know what they mean, and so I overlook the misuse of the word digital, or the if you like, the careless use of the word digital, and it doesn't bother me.
Lazy.
Yeah, there are other things that do really rattle my cage. Like, do you notice when once upon a time you used to say we're gonna do this and we're gonna do it now, or we're going to do this quickly? Now you do it at pace. Everything is done at pace, and you don't work within a business environment anymore. You work within a business ecosystem. And that, I mean, why use the word ecosystem in that context? It's not necessary.
Neither was the word environment in your first example.
That's true. That's true.
You work in business.
All right, then. How's this one? When we're talking about digital, anything digital, apparently what we're talking about is leveraging disruptive technologies. I don't know where to start with that one. I mean, leveraging for a start is mispronounced because it's leveraging.
I have to be honest, I quite like leverage, however you want to pronounce it. I'm happy with that as an example of, as I said to you, that language changes, it moves and new words come in. But I understand that a lever is using something small to move something big. And that's what you're talking about. It's pictorial, it's graphic.
It's a good metaphor. It's a good metaphor. But But why pronounce it that way? And disruptive technology. I don't think disrupting things is actually a very positive thing, is it?
I think it's childish.
Yeah.
For the being disruptive
and awkward.
For the sake of being disruptive.
But talking about digital disruptive technologies, how many dimensions do you think there are, Phil, to the universe? Because I always thought that there were only
millions,
three.
More every day. No, they're growing all the time, aren't they?
They are.
How many are there?
Well, if you're talking about BIM, and we were talking about BIM just now, and of course BIM being building information modelling, guess how many dimensions there are to BIM now?
I'm going to guess seven.
Whoa, you're being ambitious there, Phil. Last time I looked, there were six.
Oh, they'll find a seventh. I'll patent it.
Okay, I'm trying to remember what they are. I mean, there are the three dimensions that we all inhabit, up, down, and side to side. That's four, isn't it? No, that's up, down, that's three. The fourth dimension is time. So if you're talking about fourth dimensional BIM, you're talking about how things progress and develop over time. The fifth dimension, I think, is... Oh, I can't remember. One of them is supply. It's the flow of materials. And that's either the fifth or the sixth dimension. I can't remember. But... you see, I think the more dimensions you add, the less it actually means. And we're not talking about dimensions now. We're talking about factors, if you like, or contributory factors. But no, they have to be dimensions. So you're working in six dimensions now. I think people talk about that to make it sound as if they're doing more than they actually are.
Well, going back to my starting point, I'm saying the two particular bits of jargon, which I want, and I've mentioned before my dislike of this term, because again, it useless. It doesn't mean anything. Modern methods of construction.
Yes.
I mean, I did history A level, and modern history. I actually can't remember whether it began with the Renaissance or the Tudors, but that's what modern means in the grand scheme of things. Now, I know there's another definition of modern which means beyond the normal practice, somehow moving into the future. Yeah. And I suppose that's what it means by modern in that sense. But there's nothing very modern about, if you want to use modern in that sense, in the moving into the future, about being outside the norm, there's nothing very modern about prefabricating something in a factory. We've been doing it for decades. There's nothing very modern about a precast concrete beam instead of pouring it in situ. The methods that they're employing, I have no doubt, are great methods and the right solutions to the problem. It might be absolutely the best way forward to, in fact, I'm sure it is, build a bridge next to the motorway and then wheel it into place rather than shut the motorway for 6 months or whatever. Much more sensible. But don't try and kid me that that's a modern method of construction. It's just a sensible method of construction. It's a method of construction. Where does this modern come from?
Well, it's modern insofar as maybe 10 years ago you couldn't have done it like that. I mean,
talking
about jacking a bridge into place. I mean,
we've had Goldhofer. The only thing that depends on is Goldhofer trailers and hydraulic jacks, and we've had those for decades.
Yeah,
a couple of decades at least. It irritates me, and I think if people should talk about specifically what you're talking about. Are you talking about precasting? Are you talking about prefabrication of, or are you talking about pods? There's something hugely different about a bathroom pod for a Travelodge tower block, for example. Mm-hmm. That modern method of construction, or a wooden roof truss, which is put together in a factory. And comes on site on the back of a lorry, but to try and draw some sort of equivalence to those two things, it seems bogus to me.
Well, I know what you mean, because when you're talking about modern methods of construction, and that of course is often abbreviated to MMC, that covers so many different things. And as you say, some of them are in situ. I mean, I've seen sort of sacrificial formwork systems for casting concrete structures in situ, described as MMC, modern methods of construction. It's not off-site, which is often used as an alternative to MMC. A lot of people assume that modern methods of construction do actually mean off-site. Not necessarily. It's just a different way of doing things. And yes, I suppose modern methods of construction does become pretty meaningless when it starts to embrace all sorts of different technologies which aren't related and which perhaps have evolved from systems that have been in place for a long time.
That's what we used to call it, didn't we? We used to call it system building. Yes. That was the 60s term. That was
system building, yeah.
Until they started falling down.
That's true. Jargon has always been with us. It just changes and it evolves. And every week something new comes out and you think, why are you using that term? The one that I found the Americans use a lot, especially in American politics. And I was really dismayed to hear the BBC pick this up and start using it themselves. Whereas when people are talking about the way a politician appears in the public eye, they talk about the optics.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, but when...
Gin and vodka, that's what comes to my mind.
Yeah, exactly. When I was at university, an optic was that upside-down bottle behind the bar.
That's still an optic. That's still an optic.
Or it's a pair of binoculars. But no, the optics now mean how you appear in the public eye, how things look. And I think that's an abuse of English, but we're used to that from the Americans. And the other thing, I don't know if you've noticed this, but people don't reconsider things anymore and they don't report back on a topic or return to an issue. They circle back. Have you noticed that?
My absolute bugbear. If we're just talking about abuse of language, even BBC News, the big newspapers, everyone does this now, and it does my blooming head in. Overuse of pre. Everything has to be pre.
Oh yeah, you pre-order things. Once upon a time, you just ordered
it.
And now you
have
pre-order
to
it.
You have to now pre-book your theatre tickets.
Yeah.
You can't book your theatre tickets anymore. They've got to be pre-booked.
You're absolutely right, yes.
And
pre-prepared. Yes.
Anyway, good stuff, David. Have we moaned enough for 1 week?
No, I think probably, yeah.
Well, I would like to end with a slight recant on something I said earlier, if it's still in. I may have suggested that I thought disruption was a bad thing. I'm cynical about people who claim to be disruptors. Actual disruption I have no problem with. I quite enjoy it. And it reminds me of a quote I saw this week, an announcement. There's the big Japanese crane manufacturer, Tadano, who are not disruptors, a very conservative company, but they've got a new chief executive has been appointed. First one not called Tadano, interestingly. And he said that, it was a quote from him, that taking over the job from Mr. Tadano, he says, "Mr. Tadano has remarked to me that innovation is brought about by the young, the foolish, and the outsiders of our world. While my age precludes me from claiming the first of these characteristics, I certainly possess the other two." This guy's late 50s or something. I love the idea that he's, you know, claimed to be foolish and an outsider. So, at risk of sounding a bit like Dominic Cummings, I think we dedicate this week's podcast to the young, the foolish and the outsiders, for they are the innovators. I like that idea. So if you're young, foolish and or an outsider, go get them, folks. But David and I, who are merely foolish, we'll be back here again, same time next week. Cheerio.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.